It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Residents of Wilkinsburg met last night with police and municipal leaders at a community forum called by Mayor Marita Garrett, who criticized law enforcement after the acquittal of Sharon Shelton this month for the mass shooting in Wilkinsburg 4 years ago. Mayor Garrett is in our studios. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me.
Madam Mayor, what were your hopes going into the meeting last night, and how would you describe the atmosphere?
So the hopes was, and part of, again, we hold the public safety forums regularly. So overall, the hopes are to have a productive conversation where people leave not only empowered, but wanting to continue to work together and, you know, have dialogue that leads to proactive action. So understanding last night, especially with the timing of everything that's been going on, just making sure that it was still a productive and respectful one of the different speakers that we had participating. And it was eventful, to say the least.
Eventful, to say the least, and what to say the most.
Both sides. But yet still very productive, I felt.
Okay. One of the speakers whom you invited was Allegheny County Police Chief Coleman McDonough. He promised to work more closely with residents and officials. What are you hoping that comes from that pledge?
Yeah. So it was really great to have him there, because one of the things he shared last night is that we actually did have a phone call that last Monday after my statement and his statements. So he accepted the invitation. He was there. He brought another member of the Allegheny County Police Department. And something really important that he said last night, that he wanted to build bridges. So actions, again, speak louder than words. So by his presence being there, by saying that he does not want to be viewed as strangers anymore, they don't want to be viewed as the agency that just comes in whenever there's a homicide or there's a serious crime, but really that, you know, we have those same relationships with them as Wilkinsburg residents do with our own police department.
Mm-hmm. That term you used, eventful, did it apply to a reaction to Chief McDonough?
Well, you know what's interesting? It when it was time for questions for him, there was only maybe one or two questions. And then that's when you had some of the outside protesters try to bum rush inside. So I don't think it was necessarily a reaction to him specifically, because there was a little bit of a time lag between that.
Mm-hmm. He said, quote, "Cops aren't going to solve this problem. It's going to be a groundswell of community action with all our partners involved," end quote. Your reaction?
Absolutely. You know, the onus is not on just one agency or one authority to solve these problems that we're having in the community, specifically around gun violence. It is going to take all of us speaking out, acting out. Again, if you see something, letting, you know, your trusted officers know. We're one person that lives on one street or one house. So it really, we need the whole community coming together to share that. So I absolutely agree with his statement.
Part of the discussion last night centered around strategies to prevent community violence, not just respond to it, but prevent it. One model was called CURE. It treats gun violence like a public health epidemic and deploys outreach workers and violence interrupters to mitigate conflict on the street before it actually gets worse. Is this something that Wilkinsburg was already pursuing before the verdict?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So this is actually something that has been coming down the pipeline probably mid-summer, last summer, especially in 2018, where we saw an increase of homicides, not only in Wilkinsburg and the county. That's when I knew we had to get serious about addressing this as a public health epidemic. The Gun Violence Prevention Department of the Allegheny County Health Department reached out to us last summer about a partnership where they were applying for funding to implement CURE violence in here. So this is something that was been in the pipeline way before February 14th, 2020.
Will it require funding? Do you already have some funding in place?
Yes. So they've received funding from the state, the Pennsylvania Crime and Delinquency Department. And so the Allegheny County Health Department is the authority overseeing that, but in close partnership with our police department and myself.
All right. Already in the pipeline from last summer. Are you in the process now?
So they have just actually hired three workers, two of those which will be the violence interrupters, and one which will be the outreach worker, kind of serving as a case worker, and they will start getting to work April.
Mm-hmm. So the CURE program, it sounds a lot like existing outreach in East Liberty, Homewood, by men behind Mad Dads. They attended last night as well. Did they offer any tried and true wisdom?
Absolutely. So, you know, they shared a little bit about their mission, and they also provided a call to action, because part of why they've been successful is that they have a great collective of men, and also women are included in their group, but specifically in regards to the men, but that they need more men to join them. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's great about this CURE Violence program. You know, you have the outreach work that Mad Dads has been doing in our region, but yet you're pairing it now with funded research that we can really kind of get to that root of the cause, in addition to continuing the outreach.
And it gets to the health component as well, not just the violence and responding to the aftermath of the violence. Talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely, because the thing is, we look at violence as just that. Oh, someone picked up a gun, someone shot, someone's mad. But why? Why are they mad? What is going on in society? What is promoting some of these violent behaviors? So we have to look at the root of it. Gun violence is a public health epidemic, just as the opioid crisis is a public health epidemic as well. But we need to start treating it as a disease. Where is the root coming from? Most likely trauma. How do we stop it from spreading and infiltrating further our community and other communities? So really looking at it in the health component, and also that it is a disease.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Garrett, why do you feel like this more holistic approach might reach people in Wilkinsburg in ways that maybe other strategies elsewhere or in Wilkinsburg have not?
I mean, almost for what you just said, because other strategies haven't worked. And, you know, we're seeing as a result of, if you continue to do the same things, you will produce the same results. So it's time to acknowledge gun violence for what it is. I know this probably sounds like a broken record, but for the disease and illness that it is, and not just a societal issue. Yes, it is that too, but it also is a health issue. So once we start to address all the components, then that's where we can start to see some positive changes and hopefully reduction of gun violence.
I have just about 90 seconds left. All this comes in the wake of the acquittal of Sharon Shelton. He was acquitted in the murders of five people, including one who was pregnant. You criticized county police and prosecutors on Facebook for their, quote, reckless handling of the case. After talking last night, do you still feel the same way today?
I do. I still feel that way, especially with the district attorney's office, as we saw that, you know, 3 days after I made my statement, that the Post-Gazette published a very lengthy article showing, detailing all of those missteps and how there was evidence that didn't get accepted or admitted into the trial.
Have you heard from DA Zappala?
Nope, but there's been many invitations for them to participate in our forums and to reach out and help to build those bridges.
In our last 30 seconds, so the DA basically said that Wilkinsburg leaders should do more to ensure safety of their community. What do you feel like you can do?
I've been doing the public safety forums, the community conversations, making sure residents feel engaged and empowered in our civic structure and municipal government.
That's Wilkinsburg Mayor Marita Garrett. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, hear about how patients at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh are starring in their own TV and radio shows, which broadcast to hospital television screens. Plus, have you ever wanted to enjoy your own boat without the hassle of maintaining it? We might have the answer. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, artist Andy Warhol dies in New York City in 1987. Warhol was born and raised in Pittsburgh to Lemko parents, growing up in Allegheny City, now the North Side. He graduated from Shenley High School and Carnegie Mellon University before moving to New York City. There, he found success in commercial and advertising art, designing for magazines and developing his technique. In the 1960s, he solidified his place as a pop artist, exhibiting his works like the Campbell Soup Can in galleries on the East and West Coasts. He's also remembered for making iconic paintings of American celebrities, including Marilyn Monroe and Elvis. He's buried at St. John the Baptist Byzantine Catholic Cemetery in Pittsburgh's South Side. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There are for-hire signs all over Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, a mostly rural area near the Maryland border that voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in 2016. The area has long pulled in migrant laborers to dairy and fruit fields, but now more families from other countries are settling down here. But an economy dependent on cheap labor puts stress on other institutions. As part of Keystone Crossroads' Embedded 2020 series, Laura Benshoff reports on how the local public schools are struggling to meet students' needs.
Navigating a new school is a challenge for anyone, but for 15-year-old Freddie Garcia Morales, even reading his school's calendar has a learning curve.
Tomorrow's going to be the 17th.
Okay.
You look at this. It's a red box like this. Okay?
Okay.
Freddie's at a church in downtown Chambersburg, the seat of rural Franklin County. That's where Sue Marshall runs a volunteer English as a second language program. She helps Freddie decode his spring schedule.
It says the tentative start of the second semester.
Okay.
That's when your second semester classes start.
Okay.
Got it?
Yeah.
Freddie likes to play keyboards in church and thinks about becoming a mechanic or a police officer one day. He knows education can open doors to a better life, but he's been skipping school a lot this year. When I first talked to him and his mom about it in December, he made some excuses. He says he doesn't like using the computer in English class, and he doesn't like wood shop because there's dust.
Sometimes there's a lot of dust that gets kicked up. One time, it went on my nose and I got a nosebleed.
But there's something else, too. Freddie's from the mountains of western Guatemala. And his first language is a Mayan one, called Mam. He made the trek to Chambersburg with his mother and little sisters a couple of years ago, following their dad, who's undocumented. They requested asylum, saying family members had been murdered for being indigenous and are waiting for their day in court. In the meantime, Freddie enrolled at the local high school and was put in English as a second language classes, where he realized he has a lot of ground to cover.
I started studying here, and little by little, I learned a lot of Spanish. And little by little, I learned a little English.
Freddie's story is getting more common. In the last few years, there's been more people coming to the U.S. from Central America than Mexico, especially from Guatemala. And where there used to be more migrant laborers, now more families like his are coming. These changes at the U.S. southern border can be felt all the way in Chambersburg.
They're all stagrants now, I would say the majority of them, versus migrants.
Stagrants?
We call them stagrants.
That's Joe Padasak, the former superintendent of the Chambersburg Area School District. Franklin County ranks near the top in the state for dairy farms and fruit orchards. Warehouses and distribution centers for big brands like Target have cropped up. Padasak says all those jobs, along with lots of churches and rental properties, means the area is attractive to immigrant families. But getting kids to stay in school has been a challenge.
Because we always had a dropout problem in ninth grade. Many is cultural. Latino children, when they get to that level, a lot of times they're out of there.
Part of the issue is that the school system isn't adapting quickly enough. The number of students learning English in Chambersburg more than doubled to over 800 in the past decade. But in total, only one more ESL staffer was added. Federal law says public schools have to educate all kids, regardless of their background. But that's very expensive, and local taxpayers haven't had the will to pick up the tab.
We are a fiscally very tight budget school district, like most.
Dion Betts is the new school superintendent.
But even so, we are going to be asking for another EL teacher. It's the area of the most significant need.
State funding has lagged too. As a result, ESL education suffers. At Freddie's school, only about 16% of English learners are making the language progress they're supposed to. Fewer than half graduate in 4 years. Both measures are well below the state average. Rodrigo Ortiz, who heads up a Latinx advocacy group in the area, says the largely white local leadership is to blame.
Decisiones de blancos.
Decisions by white people made for Hispanics are decisions for white people. There aren't changes that really reflect the needs of the Hispanic community.
Ortiz says he sees it all the time. Kids who feel they have no future in school and go to work in landscaping or farming. The low-wage jobs on offer are a strong pull, and school often fails to compete. A few weeks after I met Freddie, the school district's truancy officer called his family. Sue Marshall, with that local church, drove Freddie and his mom to the meeting, where the officer told them he'd missed more than a month of school.
He seemed even shocked in the meeting that he had missed 33 days of school. Like, his mouth was open.
She says Freddie went in defensive, but he slowly admitted that he just doesn't like school.
He gets homework, doesn't know how to do it. Teachers are not happy because he hasn't done his homework, and so it's just a vicious cycle.
For much of the year, Freddie was failing almost all of his classes. He told me he gets lost in class and then sometimes gets in trouble for causing a disruption when he asks for help.
Sometimes the teacher explains things and I don't understand. When I ask something, all the students laugh and joke.
There's also bigger things on his mind than attendance. His dad, who, unlike the rest of his family, had no permission to be in the U.S., has been deported. His mom's diabetes is acting up, and her legs ache.
She needs medicine, also to pay for rent and electricity. I have to look for work.
The family needs money right now, but if he keeps skipping school, they could be hit with truancy fines or scrutiny from child welfare. Since that meeting, Freddie has been going to school regularly, but part of him has been planning for a future where he doesn't make it to graduation.
I was thinking if I don't finish school, I have two sisters. I was thinking I would say to them, study. That's how you get a good life.
Freddie wants to support his family, even at the expense of his own future. He says those are the kinds of sacrifices his parents made for him. Laura Benshoff, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads Embedded 2020 Project is election year coverage that puts people, not politicians, at the center. You can find more at whyy.org/embedded2020. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Patients at any hospital can watch TV from their rooms to pass the time between procedures and checkups. But UPMC Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh is now putting their patients on those hospital room TVs with a brand new state-of-the-art television and radio studio. For The Confluence, 90.5 WESA's Kylie Kaczynski sat down with the Dream Big Studios Child Life Specialist Coordinator, Riley Hammond.
So you have a bunch of activities for children here in what you call medical free zones. These are areas where there's no talk about diagnoses or procedures. Why are these areas such a big part of what Children's does for its patients?
Sure. So our areas here at the hospital typically include playroom setups. And here at Dream Big Studio, we're essentially an electronic playroom of sorts. So providing both radio and TV opportunities where kids can be the talent and also see the behind the scenes production side of things and get their hands on that. These areas are medical free zones, just like you said. And what that really does for kids is gives them an open opportunity to choose how they want to engage, how they want to play and express themselves, whereas so often the choice and control is taken away from them. So the nurse is deciding what they're doing and when they're doing it, or the doctor is saying, yeah, you have to leave your room to go get this test done, etc. So in our play areas, the studio, our music and art therapy spaces, we give that choice and control back to kids, which ultimately helps them heal.
So let's talk about how that helps them. Part of this is obviously to get their minds off of what they're here dealing with. But what tangible effect does that have on their ability to fight whatever ailment they're in here facing?
In the world of child life, we have some research and evidence-based practice, but it is difficult to quantify those actual results, but here are some examples that we've seen at the studio. For instance, a patient came in to be on a show, and she came in the studio in a wheelchair, and then mid-show, she decided that she didn't need her wheelchair and was standing because she was playing and having a good time, and then leaving the studio, she walked out without it, forgetting about the wheelchair. Ultimately, we see a change in their affect and how their overall spirit is a little more positive, a little more lifted than perhaps how we see them in their room when they are surrounded by all the medical equipment and thinking about why they're here at the hospital.
Kids here have toys and video games and whatever else to pass the time in these other medical free zones. How did the idea of a TV studio come about?
We are not the first radio and TV studio to exist in a children's hospital. Studios have existed for almost 20 years. However, ours is unique in that we are fully philanthropy funded, as well as we have both capabilities of having a radio side of our space and a TV side. The studios that exist are either one or the other.
So to look around here, you've got a lot of the equipment that we see at the WESA studios. You've got a very beautiful mixing console over there. What has it been like seeing these kids explore with this technology and explore with expressing themselves with all these toys, basically?
Sure. So the studio is really intended to be hands-on for kids, certainly with some adult supervision. But we want to make sure that kids are able to interact with what we have. Buttons especially are something that kids are super excited to see. All the buttons that you described here at the talent mics on the radio desk, kids can use and adjust their headphone volume and figure out what does this cough button even mean. Our mixing console has automated faders, which is really exciting. So for a kid to be able to press the on button and see the fader jump of like they just did that. I'd say the excitement is what is most notable. Many, many of the kids who visit here have never been in this sort of setting or in a studio. There have been a couple who, through school or through other interviews they've done, they have experienced a little bit of this world, but often we're seeing this is a brand new experience and something that is just really memorable for them of their time here at Children's.
I should offer a quick broadcast 101 lesson for those listening. A cough button would cut the mic so that the person on the mic could cough without that recording. And then a mixing console is the big fancy board with all the buttons, and the faders are the levers you pull up and down to adjust the volume. So you said the kids get their hands on pretty much everything in here. Tell me about the role of a supervisor in here and what do they help the kids with?
So here at the studio, I help coordinate the programming and show content that is going on air, involving how kids are going to be on air, what their job or role would be, do they just want to be part of the audience, etc. And being open a little over a month now, we've primarily focused shows over in the TV studio. With that, we've yet to have kids who want to be a camera operator, for instance, but when we have a child who wants to do that, we have an adult who would provide some guidance prior to the show airing of here's the zoom, here's the focus, giving them some simple instructions where they do have that autonomy and control over I am getting to do this, but then with some boundaries and guidance of this is live TV that's going closed circuit to our hospital and we want to be mindful about what we're showing everyone. Here on the radio side, that can look like a few different things. So understanding when we want mics to be on, understanding volume and perhaps giving some guidance over, okay, if you hear somebody start to get a little loud and we have a light sensor that shows us for feedback, if your light starts getting yellow or red, we're going to turn the fader down a little bit. All of that is certainly within the realm of how kids can engage. And then again, just having that adult presence of if they get nervous, if they forget a direction, having that adult be able to step in to take over.
So we've covered tech and the responsibilities of a supervisor. So let's talk about the fun stuff. What kind of shows are you working on?
So we just had our first cooking show this past week. It was featuring a local baker, Jasmine Cho, who's also a Food Network champion. And we also partner with someone in the community called Dr. Sparks. His real name is Carl Smith, and he is a former Amazon employee and a biophysicist who has this person persona called Dr. Sparks, where he goes into schools or in the community and does either a performance style show or what he calls 10-cent stories. And here in Dream Big Studio, our show with him is Typewriter Stories with Dr. Sparks, where a child can come in, tell him, I want a story about a rainbow. And together, the child and him write that story while we record it, and then later edit that into a show with multiple kids' stories. And really, the sky's the limit with Dream Big Studio. So when we think about programming, it can be anything and everything. But ultimately, the whole design of the space is for a child to come here and say, I want a show doing voice acting. And then between myself, our video producer, that child, we work together to come up with how are we going to make that happen for them. Any show concept goes through a review process with our multidisciplinary advisory board. But then ultimately, we see that show through fruition, where that child not only had their idea, but they were able to participate in whatever way. Was it that they were going to do the acting, that they were more directing, that they just had the idea and wanted other kids to be part of it. So we've yet to have that. Again, being that we've been open a month, we've been doing a show a week, but we will continue to grow, continue to add programming weekly, and see that as something that will be a huge highlight and hit for kids.
I had a chance to sit down with one of Children's Hospital's little broadcasters, Vinny Savini. Vinny is currently at Children's receiving treatment for complications related to an intestinal transplant. Let's hear about his experience. Vinny, thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
You are welcome.
So what did you think when you first found out that Children's was going to have this big TV and radio studio?
My mind, it exploded like a bunch of times. I was like Kevin McAllister. But in a good way.
So what shows have you worked on? What kind of activities have you been doing down here?
I did a cookie show.
What did you do on that show?
I made some Valentine cookies, and I enjoyed it, kind of.
Do you think that you'd want to do something in TV or radio as a job someday?
Yes!
What's your dream job?
Voice actor, which I'd probably be good at because I'll make lots of people laugh.
All right, Vinny, thanks so much for taking time.
You're welcome.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kylie Kaczynski. I'm joined by Riley Hammond in the Dream Big Studio at UPMC Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, a new in-hospital TV studio. So you hear Vinny talking there about how excited he's been about this space. Have you noticed, have you heard from his parents, any positive effect this has made on him, whether it be his overall mood or his overall therapy being a patient here?
That is a great question. This morning after I talked to him about being part of this interview, I was stopped in the hallway by his grandmother. So his parents have been here and grandparents as well. And she talked about this weekend, about all he was asking for was, when is Riley going to be here so I can be in the studio. He and his mom came down to watch the studio monitor to see the shows that are recorded that loop and play. And overall, the grandmother just raved about this has lifted his spirits and made him want to get out of his room and be social and have some controlled chaos. His grandmother was so impressed. She's like, you just managed him so well on Friday when he was very energetic, but again, able to choose what he wanted to do, which ultimately, whether he's realizing it or not, is boosting his mood and his spirits.
So you're a child life specialist. What does that mean in the context of creating these medical free zones, and how does that position you to be able to serve these kids?
Child life specialists have existed in pediatric hospitals since the 70s. And here at UPMC Children's, we have many, many child life specialists covering all areas of the hospital. For the studio design, it was really important to have a child life specialist staff the studio to maintain the mindset of how we work with children who are hospitalized, how we can adapt based on different developmental needs and physical abilities. Really sort of this whole idea of having a yes experience. So rather than being told, no, you can't do that, you can't touch this, whatever, well, how can we make this a yes to what you're wanting to do?
So staying in the hospital can be an isolating experience, especially for kids. Can patients who maybe aren't well enough to actually run the equipment or be around other kids, do they get a chance to come down here and try the studio out?
Oh, I'm glad you asked this. With all of the studio space, a child who is on certain isolation precautions can come have a one-on-one experience, and then we maintain our infection prevention practices and cleaning. They're not able to co-mingle with other kids, but they are at least able to come to the space. On the flip side, what efforts are in place to really engage the hospital at large is the studio goes to all 313 inpatient rooms, as well as our emergency department, our infusion areas, and that lends itself to have a bigger reach than what our typical playrooms, special events, and other spaces have.
So what you're saying is that what you guys create in here is essentially broadcasted on the television screens in all of the other hospital rooms.
Correct. So both with a recorded programming that's looped on our channel and when we go live. And with some live programming, and we've already done this multiple times, there are materials that accompany the show. So a show that is art-based that has a bag of materials is delivered to any kid who wants to tune in when we go live, let's say at 3 o'clock, and participate. And they get to follow along and engage in that way. This really reaches the kids and families where they're at to be able to participate in some way. A feature of the studio that's not live yet that is getting fixed and hopefully will be working very soon is a phone element. So our studio will have 2 phone lines where kids can call in from their room during a show, and that has a lot of capabilities. So one, it allows 2 kids who are on isolation who haven't engaged with other kids to be able to talk to each other. Let's say an expert from a museum here where they want to ask the expert a question, they can call in and do that. Here on the radio side, I envision a music call in where they can have a song request and really allowing them to, in essence, be in the studio without physically being here because of what other constraints they have.
So you came to Pittsburgh from Texas to run this program, which is a pretty big vote of confidence in its future. What do you hope to do next with Dream Big Studio?
Continue growing. So like I said, our programming is once a week right now. And as our staff continues to grow, and as we continue to have more shows and experience here, I am so excited to see more partnership with the community, having kids' shows, ideas come to life, basically all of it.
Riley Hammond is a child life specialist coordinator of the Dream Big Studio, a new TV studio and radio studio in UPMC Children's Hospital. Riley, thanks so much for taking time.
Thanks for coming here today, Kylie.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Have you ever looked at Pittsburgh's Three Rivers on a bright, sunny day and thought wistfully, man, I wish I had a boat? One new business to the Pittsburgh area hopes to capitalize on that urge. Michael Hills is the owner and general manager of Freedom Boat Club Pittsburgh. Michael, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
The old adage says, 2 best days for any boat owner is the day you buy it and the day it sells. You're really sort of going to the middle bits right here.
Exactly.
So that's the best time, though, and that's what you want people to enjoy.
Exactly. You know, Pittsburgh, I really think, has needed an alternative to get access to our beautiful Three Rivers, and Freedom Boat Club allows you to do that without the hassle and expense of owning a boat.
Freedom Boat Club, one of the oldest boat clubs in the nation, but it's present here in Pittsburgh, is new. You began the Pittsburgh branch last May. So what's the origin story of bringing a service like this here to our Three Rivers?
Great question. So I'm a longtime boater in Pittsburgh. Started boating in Pittsburgh in 1992 before boating was cool and before, you know, all the developments on the North Shore and the South Side really has beautified the river. And we felt that there was a real opportunity for people to get more access to boating here in Pittsburgh. And I found out about the Freedom Boat Club franchise in Annapolis, Maryland, when we had a boat there for a while, too, and thought to myself, geez, you know, somebody ought to do that in Pittsburgh, and wouldn't that be a great retirement job? And so here I am.
How many boats do you have available?
We have 5 in our fleet currently, but we have a 8 to 10 member per boat ratio. So as we have more members join, we buy more boats.
Hmm. And you maintain them, all that boring stuff that your members don't have to do. It's all taken care of by your team. Where do you dock the boats?
Our fleet of boats is at the marina at Station Square. So you have great access to the rivers and to all the restaurants and fun stuff to do around the point.
This is your first full season, but you offered boats last year. What was that reaction like?
The immediate reaction I get is, what a great idea. Somebody should have done this in Pittsburgh years ago. And or I've always wanted a boat, but, you know, and there's fill in the sentence from there. Mm-hmm. Didn't want to own it, didn't want to wax it, didn't want to fix it, you know, all those things.
So people stop by Station Square. How do they check them out, so to speak?
So we have an online app as well as a reservation system. And with four clicks, you can pick a boat, you can pick a time, you can pick a day, and you're reserved for that afternoon.
Do you offer any training for newbies, or does a person say, hey, I got this, and then they say to you, where are the brakes? Where are the turn signals?
No brakes or turn signals on a boat, Kevin. Yes, we do. We have Coast Guard certified captains on staff that do a four-hour new member orientation with our new members. Whether you've been boating for 30 years or never touched the helm in your life, we put you on our boats and train you so that you're comfortable and safe behind the helm.
All right. Do you ever keep your fingers crossed when you let one of your boats go, though?
Maybe I would admit there's a couple members that make me a little nervous, but no, you know, really, our Coast Guard captains do, certified captains do a great job of training our members. And, you know, once they are through the certification, they're really good at what they do. And the other thing is we offer unlimited training. So, you know, if a month later a member says, you know what, I'm really comfortable, but I'm a little nervous pulling in and out of the dock.
Mm-hmm.
We put them back on the boats with the captains, and they can do some more training.
This is a franchise in a larger company, so people can use your service elsewhere as well?
Yeah, so members join, and they get unlimited use of our fleet of boats in Pittsburgh. But just as cool, they get four times per year reciprocal access at all 213 other locations across the country.
213?
Yeah, and in fact, we've recently opened, I think, four or five in Canada, and they opened their first three in France.
All right, so not only in this country, but in other countries as well.
Yeah, big expansion plans in Europe.
All right. Do you have favorite places that you like to boat besides our Three Rivers?
Yeah, Miami.
So it's not just on rivers, not just, is it on any water?
Yeah, lakes, rivers, a lot of ocean locations, you know, from Maine all the way to Florida, San Diego, all the way to Seattle.
Mm-hmm. So that's your favorite because it's the open seas or not?
I just love Miami.
Oh, okay. So how do people join the club?
So you pay a one-time upfront entry fee. It's not an annual fee. You pay it once and then you're in the club. Then mm-hmm. you pay monthly dues. The monthly dues are 12 months a year. But again, you get access for the six-month boating season in Pittsburgh and all around the country in the off-season. So you can boat all winter long.
All right. So somebody's sort of interested. They're on. Sounds like fun, but they're on the fence. Really, why?
Well, if you look at the difference in cost between owning a boat versus joining the club, it's easily a third to a half of as expensive. That's half of the reason. The other reason is the work that's involved and the maintenance that's involved in owning a boat. Some people just want to have the fun and not have to do all the work. That's what we're all about.
And so how much?
So normally our one-time entry fee is $6,000 up front. We're doing a pre-spring sale for $3,500. You pay that once. And then your monthly dues are $350 a month. And once you're in the club, your dues never go up.
Michael Hills is the owner and general manager of Freedom Boat Club Pittsburgh. Michael, thanks so much for the time and enjoy our rivers.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's show or would like to catch up on past episodes, just check out WESA.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, with production assistance from Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.